Hey there. Welcome to the Envision podcast. My name is Karthik and I will be your host for today's episode. On this podcast, we bring together people who have had a positive impact on the blind and visually impaired community from across the world and share their stories with you. Today, on our podcast, we have Bianca Prince, who is a trailblazer in the development of global accessibility at ING. She tirelessly advocates to increase the attention on the economic value of the disability community and is a super passionate triathlon runner. Today, we'll be diving deep into her world and learn about the impact that she's created. So welcome, Bianca. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, all right. So when we usually do these podcasts, you know, I'd like to go back to the very early years of the person's childhood and want to understand what are the events and the people that shaped maybe the first 10 years of your life and how has that had an impact on your later years? You know, we'd like to really go back to your origin story, you know?
Oh, that's a good one. I didn't prepare for that. That's nice. It's quite interesting because I grew up, my parents are sailors, so we lived on a ship when I was a child. And that meant that the first 6 years of my life, I've been living with my parents. And when I was six, I had to go to boarding school, especially for kids whose parents are sailors in the Netherlands. And the interesting part is actually that I had already a visual disability at the time. I've been born with cataracts, and it's an inherited version of it, meaning that I had low vision at the time. I was on the edge of being a child going to blind school and visual disabled school, or going to regular boarding schools for children whose parents are sailors. When my parents were looking around, it was not practical to go to the blind school. So I went to regular school, which was interesting because I was the only child with a severe visual disability. That meant I had a different desk, I had different books, I had a lot of assistance and support, which made my early years in school very challenging. On the other side, I already learned quite young that if I wanted to make something out of my life, it had to be me and not somebody else who would help me out on that one. So I already started on a young age to develop myself and see how I could do what others could do and I was supposed not to be able to be doing based on a visual disability. And I think that shaped me a lot. I'm still the person who likes to do the unimaginable things and who is working towards getting the job you dream about or getting the same treatment as other people. And I think that's key also to the work I currently do.
Interesting. And so when you were, you know, when you were a school, when you were, you know, I would say a slightly more special child in a school full of peers who were not visually disabled. Was that also the case when you went to university? And when did you first start becoming aware or have this drive to create or advocate for accessibility? Was the ideas about those formed in the early years of your career, or were they something that sort of happened, as you started to work, you know, be more in the workforce?
It was already when I was in the workforce. One of the key things when I started my current studies in business administration, which I'm still pursuing at the moment, was when I was faced with a reorganization in the healthcare organization I was working at the time. I run into the fact that a combination of my visual disability with some physical things which originated from birth of my daughter, I was not able to return to my regular job. So I had to find a new career, and which was okay. But I were suddenly run into all the things where people with a visual disability starting to work with computers run into. This was about 15 years ago, I guess. Yeah, 15 years ago. So in that sense, I found the problems of wanting to work by not being able to perform your job as you would like to, based on the fact that it was not the right support was not available at the time. I had not, I didn't fell into regulations, meaning that I could get screen readers and support. So from that perspective, I had to find out myself, which brought me into a lobby group for people with a disability in the Netherlands. And that's actually how I got introduced in the whole world of disability inclusion and accessibility, because before it was just about finding my way around. It was not about the community. It was more about finding my way around. So from that perspective, it really happened when I was already in the workforce.
Interesting. And so when you actually got into the workforce, you start to realize that there is no infrastructure, or there is no like a certain set, I would say, system in place to support people with disabilities, right? At that point in time, how did you actually start your path towards bringing that into your, you know, your maybe your first job? What were the things that you had to do to actually make your current, your first workplace a bit more inclusive?
Now it's more different. It's in the Netherlands, it's quite strict. You're either you fall in the group of people who get support, or you fall out. And I was just on the edge of not being able to get the support because I saw a few percent too much, which is quite interesting. So if it's like 1% too much of vision, you can get no support. And if it's 2% less, you can get support. So it's a very it's hard line. And based on that one, what I found, and that was the case actually from my perspective to get involved, was that that hard line is not fair, because it doesn't say that if you see like 35%, it's easier to get a job than it is, let's say, if you see 25%, because the challenge is still the same. You still need requirements. The only thing is the person with 25% vision gets it, and the one with 35% percentage doesn't get it. It's not the exact boundary, but it is sort of the boundary that we had. So, and that's not fair. And I think from that perspective, that's one of the key reasons why I started early on to think about, why is there a strict boundary? Why doesn't all people with a visual disability get the same treatment if they find themselves in challenging situations to find a job? Because it doesn't sound fair. It's the same thing for people who have hearing loss. If you have the same kind of hearing loss, it would be possible to be in welfare while your peer would not have an eligible for welfare. And in the Netherlands, it means if you have rights to welfare, you also have rights to workplace adjustments. If you don't, you have to go to the city and you have to ask. And then they set a sort minimum list of requirements, which often don't fit requirements of people with a certain disability. So it's quite standardized list. In my case, it was not working. So I was not able to get the right support. And, well, my friend, who saw a little bit less than me, was able to get the right support. And I think that's one, yeah, that's the key reason for me to go for this.
Interesting. And I also was reading, when I was reading your LinkedIn bio, I was reading this one line that caught my attention. You had a lot of, you know, bumps on the road on the way to your current role as like the head of accessibility at ING. And I was just wondering, you know, what were those bumps like? Because I think a lot of people, you know, who are listening to this podcast, we know are younger people with a visual impairment, just getting into the workforce. While, you know, I think we have come some way in making inclusion and disability part of the conversation, I think there's still a lot of things that, you know, that young people with a visual impairment have to go through when they go through the workforce, right? And I was wondering what those early bumps in your career were, and how did that sort of shape you or shape your ideas around accessibility and inclusion?
They already started when I completed high school and I was looking for studies, because people actually figured for me that I was not able to go to higher education based on the fact I was not able to see I was not able to see far away for me, meaning that I wouldn't be able to go to college because you have the big screens and the big rooms and stuff like that. So people decided for me, and that was one of the big bumps. So I had to prove that I was able to do things, but they also said, no, you have to go that way, and I wanted to go the other way. So I think from that perspective, the idea that people decide what fits best based on their view of your disability, while you have a very different view, that's one of the big bumps. Next to that was actually the interesting part of finding that I wanted to work. That was my goal. That was the only goal I had. The biggest challenge I found was actually getting the right support to do my job. And that was the thing where I found as a big bump in my experience, based on the fact that even if you are willing to work, you still have to fight again for the workplace adjustments you need. I think the other one, the big thing actually is the part of, if you look for a job, and especially if you're higher educated, people often expect you to work full time. And in my case, I've got cataracts. I also contracted other eye diseases in the years, meaning that I have a lower energy level. I get headaches at the end of the day, so I work less hours a day, which also leads to the automatic consequence that people think you're not able to have a senior role function, which is interesting because technically it is possible. And why wouldn't it be possible to do the job if you have the skills for it in less hours than people standardly would expect?
Yeah, and of course, it's, especially when if you're efficient at doing it, then I don't think the hours do really count in a way, right? So I think the skills and the drive to do it matters a lot more in the end.
Indeed, and I totally agree on that one, because it is about the work you do. It's not about the hours you work, it's about what you deliver. And that's the key thing. And I proved that in my role. And even still now, I'm working since 2017 in this role. Some people still ask, how do you do this? Are you sure you're working 20 hours a week? Yes, I am sure. And I really have to respect that. Last year, especially with Corona, I think a lot of people had the same experience. You were working from home. You didn't have to travel to work. So it was quite easy that your days slightly extended by the month, meaning that in the end, I really bumped into myself that I was so incredibly tired. And I found myself working, instead of 5 hours a day, I found myself working 6 hours a day, which really pulled me to a full stop when we had the Christmas holidays. And I felt so incredibly tired. And after that period of rest, it was like, you know what? Next, after this, I'm going to start working 5 hours, stop right at 5 hours a day. And it really works. And you have to respect that. And on the other side, COVID also learned me something else, that now I'm working from home, at the moment, 3 days from home, 1 day to the office. That is a good balance for me, because traveling, it takes a lot of energy. On the other side, you also want to see your colleagues. So it's balancing out. But the fact that I have now less travel hours, in my case, it's 3 hours per workday, it really saves me a lot of energy to do other fun things. And I think from that perspective, that's a very interesting learning point, to see how we can combine and how we can work, including having all the extra parts of it. Because I know a lot of people with a visual disability who are working and actually run into the problem that they don't have the energy left to meet up with friends, to hang out, even to go like the simple things like sport. And that's a sad thing. And we need to find a balance in that. And I think from that perspective, that's a great learning. And I hope that proving now that working from home is possible in a very good way. You can also have a management. You can even be a CEO working from home. So from that perspective, I really hope that for a lot of people with a visual disability, these learnings provide us with more job opportunities and accompanying careers.
Yeah, and you know, I want to now move a little bit further, you know, based on what you said into your role at ING, because ING is a huge financial institution, and you know, and being the head of accessibility, what does a day in your life look like as the head of accessibility for a huge a financial institution, you know?
It's a very practical one, actually. On the one side, it's looking at how we can set guidelines for ourselves, because, for example, our IT is asking how can we improve accessibility and what do we need to learn. And on the other side, it's also the part of, and then it gets really practical, developing a certain kind of product. We have been working on an accessible card, which is available in the Netherlands and Belgium, and other countries hopefully follow soon, meaning that we have a card with a notch, which is not a product just for the visually impaired. It's a product for all customers in those countries, meaning that there's a notch on the side, on the short side of the card, so you know, A, it's your banking card, B, how to stick your card into the payment machines. And that's a very simple thing, but on the other side, it also takes a long time to develop such idea from a concept of having a card with a notch, testing it with a group, to the point where you have everything put together to get the product into the market. Those are the nice things, because on the one side, you're really working on practical things to improve accessibility. And on the other side, you're also working on the long-term view. How do we get there? How do we improve our whole organization? And I really like that balance.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of the things that, you know, you've really worked on, I also read that you've been working on speaking ATMs and and providing more financial options for people with disabilities. Could you talk a little bit about those projects as well, because that would be really interesting for a lot of people both sighted and visually impaired listening in the audience, as to what kind of financial products or what kind of innovations can we see in the day-to-day financial products that we use, like, for example, an ATM card, a banking card, for example, or an ATM? What kind of innovations could we see happening in the next few years in these areas?
Now, I really hope from card perspective, let's start there, from the accessible card perspective, that it's not just a few countries. So we have it in our market leaders are Netherlands and Belgium. They already introduced the accessible card with a notch on the side, but I really hope to get to the point where we have it standardized for all ING customers. And in extension to that, it's also nice to learn that one of the UK banks also introduced an accessible card as a standard for all their customers. And I think from that perspective, and that counts on all banks, it should be not about putting a separate product in the market for customers with a visual disability, but putting a product in the market which is accessible for everybody. Because the accessible card with a notch, for example, is not just a beneficiary for people with a visual disability. It's also very practical if you have low hand function, because it's easier to hold the card. Secondly, speaking ATMs, the interesting part in that case was actually we already had speaking ATMs in Turkey, ING Turkey, and we had them in Poland, but we didn't have them at the time in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, we were moving to one type of ATM, which is used by all the large banks. And one of the key elements of that new ATM format was that they have to be accessible for everybody, meaning high contrast options and including speech support. In relation to that development, ING Netherlands also decided to make sure that our own ATMs who stand with local supermarkets at Schiphol Airport would have voice support too. What we did is actually the things we developed and we learned from our development in voice support for our ATMs, also with the input from Turkey and some knowledge from Poland we got, is that our learnings actually transferred to the new ATM, which is a general ATM used in the Netherlands by all large banks. So technically, we became a front runner in that one. My role in that was advisory support, but technically it is a team effort because it is the team who really works on ATMs themselves. My role as Global Head is more about giving them the support, providing them with the right connections, see which countries can provide knowledge and expertise. And from that perspective, it is a collective one. I am more the person who sets an idea and works with a team that can develop this. When it comes to, for example, customer products, we're still not there yet. We're really figuring out. I strongly see the need to make sure that as a bank, we can provide inclusive products for everybody, making sure every customer can make use of our products. On the other side, we also know that there are some other things impacting. So for example, lower incomes. Do you always have the possibility to get a mortgage? No, based on the fact that your income can be too low, for example. But how can we make sure that we also include groups, their independence? We even in unsecured welfare situations, based on the fact that in some countries your welfare depends on in combination with employment, and you say, okay, part of it is welfare, part of it is employment, meaning that your income can vary per month. And in some cases, people afterwards learn they got too much welfare, for example, or they got too less and they got extra money. But how can we make sure that all banking products are accessible for everybody? It's a challenge and it's something we need to think about. Secondly, there are quite simple things in that one we can also work on, and that's about communication, making sure that we provide, for example, the opportunity for digital accessible forms and information sheets, making sure that everybody can learn about our products. Those are the quite simple ones, but the technical one about access to products, making sure that everybody has the same access, that will be a challenge for the coming years, and especially with the European Accessibility Act coming up.
And being in this position where you're working with both the people and with the technology, my question to you would be, in order to really bring about change in not just big and small organizations, how much of a role do you think the technology plays, and how much of a role do you think people play, or is it that people play a bigger role in bringing accessibility, or does technology play a bigger role in bringing accessibility to institutions, big and small,
I think it's a well-weighed balance, because if you don't have the people who tell you what they really need, then it's really hard to build the technology. At the same time, you can build a lot of technology, but you also need to make sure that the people are able to use your technology. So it's a close balance in that one. That's why I personally always advocate not to just work with personas, but also work with people. Make sure that you test with real people. It's nice to have a minimum viable product, for example, but if the minimum viable product is not usable for, let's say, 25% or 20% of your customers, how much value does it have? So from that perspective, you need to make sure that you include people with a disability in a testing process, making sure that they can use the product. And from that part, it is really, really close balance. It's not just technical. It's not just people. It needs to be both.
And I also wanted to understand, you know, like how, I wanted to touch upon a little bit about your accessible customer journey assessment, you know, program that you actually developed. I wanted to understand a little bit more about it. And I also wanted to understand, you know, as an extension of that, as to how, you know, accessibility could be thought of in a more systematic way within organizations. I wanted to understand how that would look like. But before we dive into that, I wanted to know what a little bit more about what the accessible customer journey part is, and how did you go about actually building it? What is it actually about, you know?
The accessibility customer journey assessment is technically quite simple. It's about assessing your product right from development start, and how accessible is it? Meaning that at first, when you have an idea for a product, you already start looking around to see if this is a product which can be used by all customers. For that part, we have developed personas with certain disabilities, so you can start with a first assessment to see if a product is suitable for customers with a disability too. Second part of that is measuring, meaning that we really measure to standards. So for example, for a digital program, we could use the WCAG and say, okay, we follow on the WCAG principles. Does it fit? Does it not fit? And when the first minimum viable product is developed, we start testing with a testing group. Technically, those are the three steps we have embedded in our customer journey assessment, meaning that in any new product development, we really want our teams to work using this assessment and not as a part of saying it's for just for products for people with a disability. No, it should be for all products. We're a long way from that one, but we do see more and more teams working with this approach.
Interesting, because I think the journey or the process that you mentioned is pretty much, I think it is a very, it's an agile software development. It seems like it's an agile software development process, but accessibility sort of built in from the start. Is there a place where maybe the listeners of the podcast can find more information about this, or is it more of an internal thing that you did for ING?
No, it's more an internal thing.
Okay.
And from that perspective, we developed it for internal use. We have now done our first projects in development projects from start to end using the tool. And from that perspective, we're currently working on moving to see how we can roll out the customer assessment journey. So we did the pre-testing phase, and it really came. It's also supported, by the way, by our global process management team, who some of our colleagues actually helped develop the customer journey assessment. So from that perspective, what we really did is looking into the possibility to put accessibility in as a standard requirement based from the start, making sure the whole product development process, accessibility is part of the product development process, and in the end, making sure that you are working with the people. And so to prevent the idea that you're just assuming on personas, but making sure the product you had in mind also fits for people who really could benefit from the accessibility effort you made. There are two reasons to do it this way. One is learning from the disability community, which I think is really important, based on the fact they are the experts, so you really have to ask people themselves. And secondly, it's about making the disability community part of business, based on the fact what we technically do, and that counts for any business who works with testers, is actually you take them into your process, you make them part of a process, showing that they are an important stakeholder group for your future product developments. And I think from that perspective, that's one key thing, and that counts for all businesses, where we should look at the disability community as an important information source, as an important stakeholder with a voice which needs to be heard. And that's one of the key things when I developed the accessibility customer journey assessment, to make sure that that voice is included. And in the future, I really hope to see that it's also something businesses are going to pay for. Because if you hire a change expert and you hire him or her externally, you pay for that expertise. Why wouldn't you pay for the expertise of the disability community?
No, that's perfectly, a reasonable argument. And it's really amazing that, you're putting forward all these thoughts, which are very, in a sense, in today's landscape, they're considered quite progressive. They should be considered standard, but they're considered quite progressive. And from what we have seen, speaking to so many different companies who have been in this space, I think it's always good to start with the customer, or rather here the user, when they're building products for the disability community, rather than starting with personas, because personas always give you the more ideal outlook and doesn't really take into account all the different unique factors when it comes to working with the disability community, right?
For sure. And I think that's one of the key things which we notice now, is that the people part is really growing also within the accessibility community. At first, there was a certain group really empathizing on working with personas, making sure you had the standards okay. And if you have, for example, the POR principles, then your product should be accessible. And what I find in my experience, yes, WCAG is a great tool to say, okay, these are the things we need to do. But just saying WCAG proof does not mean it's accessible for everybody, because you still have people who fell outside the margins. And with the inclusive design approach, as it's also called, you make sure that you include people in your design. You also include the differences, and especially for the community of people with visual disabilities, you can have the same visual impairment. It does not say you see the same thing. I've got the same impairment as my mother has, for example, but we have a complete different view based on various things. The fact, for example, that my mom had an operation when she was a baby. I had an operation when she was a baby, but there's 25 years of difference in that same operation. Also meaning that medical world developed, meaning that her side is less than my side is. If I continue that one, I've got nephews and nieces who also have the same eye disease. And what you see is with generations, there is progress in what people can see and what people can do. Those are the things that even if you have exactly the same disease from genetic perspective, there's a way of difference, even if there's just 3, 4, 5 years age difference. That's one thing. So the whole community, everybody is unique. Secondly, what we also notice in this community of people with a visual disability is that the difference in perception of barriers is also very big. Because I know people who are, for example, deaf and blind, who don't feel excluded based on the fact that the environment they participate in is very accessible for them as a person. And when they encounter barriers, they find a way to work with those barriers, to work around them, to find a way how they can resolve it, or just a way to live with it, which is also fine. And then you have people who run into a barrier based on the fact that they cannot do a certain thing, or they cannot access a certain venue, for example, due to their visual disability. And instead of finding a solution, they actually start to get annoyed. And when you start to get annoyed, because I also know about being annoyed, being excluded, but when you start to get annoyed, it's really hard to find a solution. Because with annoyance, also your barriers go up. So you build a wall and you really want to make your thing happen. And I think that's not the way to go. So from that perspective, I say, let's work on the challenges and let's work on all the barriers we face and see if we can resolve it. And if we resolve it for ourselves, others can be helped with that too. Even if we all differ, even if we don't have the same vision, even if we don't have the same culture, it doesn't matter. It's about all small barriers resolved, leading to great barriers taken away.
No, and 100% agree on that, because I think, you know, the accessibility problem, it's like all problems with humans. I think, you know, with society in general, there's no like a one solution fits all approach. And I think the faster, you know, companies and businesses realize that, you know, in order to really bring more inclusion and accessibility, you have to start looking at it more as it's a people problem. And you need to think of it in a more unique, you know, way, rather than saying, okay, I'm just going to go ahead and implement a solution and I'm just going to hope that it works for throughout the company and so on. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I feel like this conversation or this podcast wouldn't really be complete without touching upon your running career, if I can call it a career, you know, or it's a hobby or a passion. And how much has that sort of shaped you as a person and maybe even the work that you do, right? Because I mean, running a triathlon is not an easy task. I have been trying for years to start, training for it. And I think it requires not just like physical effort, but it also requires tremendous mental, you know, focus and stamina to really get to where you are. So could you tell us about how running became a passion for you and how has that shaped your life and your work?
Actually, it came on my path during Corona. The thing is, I know a few people who have been active in running with the running blind community in the Netherlands. I have known some people via Twitter who do para triathlons. So from that perspective, the whole idea actually resolved from the part. It was December, and I was looking around because the gyms were still closed. So and you couldn't get outside as much based on the evening clocks and stuff like that. So I was looking for how I can find my other way in sports. Normally I go ice skating in the winter, but the ice rink was also closed. So what I did was actually I used the app on my phone and I started to run. I already was a swimmer. I already rode my bike. So from that perspective, it was just the running part that missed out. Secondly, I really like the endurance sports. Reason why is I'm not really fast. I'm the person who has a long energy range. So I can do, it's not being the best in one of the sports. It's more the combination of sports and being able to do it. And that's one of the key things where I found that the triathlon, when I was starting to run, would be an idea to try. And it was actually just a crazy idea from being bored with Corona, not being able to do a lot of stuff and finding out a new way of sports. So from that part, it was actually more of a fun part. And that led to my first triathlon indeed, 2 weeks ago, which I run in 1 hour and 55 minutes and 38 seconds, which is not a really high record. But it was also for me finding out that as I really like to do sports on myself, I prefer to do as much as I can do on my own. I did my first triathlon on my own. I didn't have a guide with, I didn't ride a tandem, for example, but I rode on myself. But on the other side, I also found challenges faced on you had to run 300 meters to the water on a very bumpy field, meaning that for me, it looks flat. So it was like after 20 steps, I was like, oh, crap, this is like really bad for my ankles. And I moved on and I run a little bit slower. So I came into the water and I found the challenging part of where do I need to go? Because there is no really clear direction. And it went on like that while I was doing the triathlon. On the other side, it was annoying to experience that it took me extra energy, which I could better use for the triathlon itself, to look around and find my way. At the same time, it was also something that I would probably get a para athlete status. But on the other side, I like to do it myself. And this was something that I would say, okay, this is something I really want to do myself for as long as it's possible. And I did it. And that's one of the key things for me. It's about making the impossible possible. And that's why I really like it. I also noticed that in sports in general, it's not really inclusive. And that's unfortunate, because if you look at running, a lot of people can run. If you have a visual disability, you can run. You can run with a guide, but you can also run on your own. If the markings are clear, if, for example, you get the volunteers at the site have very clear clothing on, and there are simple things that they can make sports more accessible. And from that perspective, I think it also inspired me that accessibility is not just about products. It's not just about services or digital environments. It's about whole society. And I already knew it. But on the other side, I also sported in my youth with a normal volleyball team. And my team members actually called out when the ball was coming from the left, because that is the side where I only see 2-3%. But on the other side, I see a lot more, so I could see the ball coming. Meaning that it's about collaborating together and working together, which takes out the barrier. And that's one of the key things I think in sports. We can do more. And if we can include people with a disability in sports, we can also include people with a disability in product, services, education, and everything we have.
And that's a great, way for me to segue into the last part of the conversation, which is a question that I ask all my guests, So what is your mantra, Bianca? If there's one, mantra that you would want to share, one thought you'd want to share with everyone listening in on the podcast, what would that be?
I think it's sort of go with the flow. I don't know. I think that would fit best for me. Go with the flow. Just see where you end up and find your way around. That's how I got to my job. That's how I found my current role. And also how I found my purpose. It's about seeing whatever, just getting where you want to be and believing in yourself, and then just go with the flow and see what comes in your path. With hard work, opportunities will arise.
That's a great way to end it, because, when you say with hard work, opportunities arise, that's something that I think, I really believe in as well. And I think the more you work hard, the more the opportunities seem to present themselves. So thank you for a really nice conversation, Bianca. It was really nice talking to you and touching upon so many aspects of accessibility that, most people tend to ignore, or even giving us a peek into how, accessibility works in big organizations. So thank you so much for joining in on today's episode.
Thank you for having me, because it was a lot of fun to do.
And for everyone listening in on the podcast, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with another episode very soon. Thank you.